Hi, this is Pep Phelan from the Melbourne Poach Centre. I'm here with Stacey Coates, who is an academic with Western Sydney Uni. Hi, Stacey.
Hi, Pep. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Stacey, tell me more about yourself. So what you're doing, what your profession is, and where you're from.
Sure. So I'm a proud Wiradjuri woman. My family's from central New South Wales. I'm currently completing my PhD. I'm investigating Indigenous leadership in higher education. And when I'm not PhDing, I'm a primary school teacher. So, and I'm a proud mum of two amazing children.
Tell me how you got interested in what you're currently doing at the moment, and what was your pathway to get there?
Getting to my PhD was actually quite unusual. It was a position that was advertised. So my two professors, Professor Michelle Trudgett and Professor Susan Page, had received an ARC grant for a wider study, and they actually advertised for the PhD student. It appealed to me because they were looking for somebody that was passionate about education, had an educational background, and had experience in leadership. And I was ticking all those boxes, being a passionate educator myself, understanding the importance of gaining a good education, understanding the challenges that Indigenous peoples have experienced in obtaining education. It just stood out, and I contacted Professor Trudgett, and the rest is history. I just fell into it. And I haven't looked back.
Fantastic. What was your educational pathway from secondary school through to now?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So obviously went through high school and went into the workforce, and then decided that I wasn't happy and I wanted to go back and study. So I tested the waters and I did a counselling diploma through a private college. And then with that, I applied to do a Bachelor of Social Science majoring in psychology as a mature age student. I was accepted at Western Sydney University to do my bachelor. Then I completed that and went back into the workforce because obviously having family, mortgage, went back into work. Then realised I was in child protection, and then I worked for New South Wales Health. I still wasn't feeling like I was where I wanted to be. And then I realised I really valued an education, and then I'd had my children and watched how important it was for them to get a good education. So with that, I decided to apply to do my master's in teaching. So I applied back at Western Sydney University and I was accepted into my master's of teaching, and then I completed that. And then I was a primary school teacher for roughly 5 years before stepping into my PhD. I didn't take any special pathways or alternative method. I went in as actually because I had to conceal my Aboriginality. I was in mainstream for my bachelor. By the time I did my master's, family, we were more supportive with being able to identify and not keep it such a secret. And so then I identified with my master's.
What motivates you to be your best and do your best every single day?
I suppose there's drive that I want to achieve for myself because I had such a hard time in primary school and even high school. Once I overcame that, like, I was determined to succeed. I was determined to not be that dumb Aboriginal girl that everybody thought or everyone labelled me as. So there's a bit of self-motivation, but then having my own children, they motivate me. I want to set an example for them, be a great role model, encourage them to do the same. And then I've got motivation from my community. I know I've got the support of my community behind me. And so I feel that the work that I'm doing now, it's not just for me. It's about centering the voices of my Aboriginal community. So that motivated me as well.
And what got you interested in your particular field or your particular profession, and what impact do you hope to have with that profession?
Okay, so obviously education is the field that we're referring to, and was prior to my PhD. I actually came across it, and I touched on this a little bit earlier. I had completed my bachelor. I'd worked in child protection. I was working with kids that were in constant crisis, and I actually was doing a clinical leadership program, and I had to do a reflection piece, and I reflected on the things that I enjoyed in my previous role. And what stood out for me is that I really wanted to help children, and I felt so strongly about ensuring that they received a proper education, because I didn't. In, as I said, primary school and high school were horrific for me. I was a dumb kid. And so I thought, well, instead of working with kids that were in crisis situations and you're in and out of their lives so quickly, if I was in the classroom in front of them, I could give them the education that they deserve. And that for me was, that's where my passion is to ensure that our kids, our mob and even non-Indigenous receive that quality education.
Yeah, fantastic. So you're in a unique position in that you're an Aboriginal woman who has a counselling and a psychology background, so you understand development and health and psychological and social health, but you're also a primary school educator as well, and you're an education academic. How do you believe that education benefits Aboriginal kids and their health and well-being?
That's a good question, and I can't answer it and try to answer it without making a reference to an article. I believe that having a solid education will provide a mechanism to obviously gain secure employment. So it falls into that socioeconomic realm and having that flow on effects, and you know, making sure that if we're in a healthy socioeconomic realm, then that goes on and improves the outcomes and well-being of Aboriginal people. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's about giving them the education, giving them the tools to then go and have a successful life.
Currently in academic circles particularly, there's these particular words of decolonize and indigenize. First of all, do you believe in those words and what they stand for? And secondly, how do you believe that we can implement these mechanisms to improving the education system for Indigenous kids in this country and also improving the outcomes for Indigenous lives?
Okay, that's a big, you know, multi-layered question there.
It is.
For me, in the educational space, this might not actually answer it, but I'll give it a go. I'm going to put those two words, decolonize and indigenitize. I'm going to put those two words on the side. For me, as an Aboriginal woman, what I think is really important is that all educators are aware and have a solid understanding of Indigenous histories. Whether we're going to decolonise the curriculum or not, the curriculum is based on, and I've done research in the higher ed space, that, you know, it's information that's pretty much come as a result of Britain and history of white men ways of writing. So I'm going to forget trying to decolonize the curriculum. I want to educate the educators on the true Indigenous knowledges. And only, I think, when we've done that, can we see a change or a shift in the curriculum. Only then will the curriculum really be decolonized. Because if you're using these buzzwords, but you don't, as a non-Indigenous, don't have the understanding of the histories, how are they going to decolonise the curriculum? Are they going to give it to the black fella and go, there you go, you've got to decolonise this for us? What's the non-Indigenous person learn from that? Nothing. I come from a different place than most people, especially, and I find in higher ed, as a, you know, new academic, I have a different way of thinking because I don't want to just focus on let's decolonize the curriculum. I want to focus on let's educate the educators. Mm-hmm. You can decolonize that curriculum all you like. What impact is that going to have if you've still got white fellas thinking white ways?
So I know you're at the moment doing some work on educating the educators. What does your work in Educate the Educators entail?
So I'm working with the department to introduce a mandatory biennial training, professional learning for public school teachers, both primary and secondary. I'm starting as in public. I'm not going to the Catholic system, private schools. And I'm starting New South Wales, but I'm hoping go national with it. But it's a slow, slow process. And I have a feeling this will end up being a postdoc because it's taking that long. There's traction, but it is quite slow. But yeah, it's just introducing mandatory training, professional learning, and not just on you need to go and talk to the community and consult with them. You're like talking about that Indigenous history and the reason why there might be difficulties engaging with Aboriginal communities in education, because it wasn't that long ago that we were denied access to education. And if non-Indigenous teachers aren't aware of that, they're not going to have an understanding of what the experience is for the Indigenous student in their classroom and their family.
Do you think that in your experience that educators that you've dealt with, non-Indigenous educators, have a solid or good understanding or accept that with colonisation came a whole stack of oppression and social disadvantage, and that now plays out in the classroom in the way that kids learn, the way that they behave and the way that they interact?
Yeah, so no, the non-Indigenous teachers have no idea. They don't, in my experience, and you know, I'm talking of a particular region in South Sydney, in those regional network meetings and have the conversations with the teachers from the school over there and the school over there, and they're just completely oblivious as to, you know, that the impact that those previous policies have still have on the kids that are in their classrooms currently. But yeah, they've got no idea. And that's why all of a sudden it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Everybody needs to stop because there's a big gap here.
So, Stacey, I know you love to be in control of a lot of things. you just go after everything at 100%, and I love that about you. If you were to be able to control the entire education system in this country, what changes would you implement straight away and what mechanisms would you use?
Oh, well, obviously the big change would be that mandatory professional learning has to be up and running. That's bang. But as far as mechanisms, that's not something that I can just go, here you go, me and Stacey, the individual, they're giving you this and this is what needs to happen. No, it needs to be done collaboratively with community. And big community involvement. It's not just the Department of Education and Stacey Coates. So, well, yeah, the mechanisms would be taking community approach, working collaboratively, demonstrating leadership skills in doing so. Yeah, ensuring that everybody's on the same page and we're working together for that one common goal.
What have you learned in your professional career about leadership, influence and impact?
Oh, this is a big one. And I learned this the hard way. You have to work collaboratively with people. You can't just go in and go, we're doing this, get with the program, or see you later. That does not work. Softly, softly. Yeah, the big thing is with leadership that it's about building those relationships with your stakeholders, internal, external, your team. Yeah, you just don't go in guns a-blazing, putting the boot in. It doesn't work. Absolutely doesn't work. There are going to be times that I've learned that you're not always going to agree with one another, and it's about unpacking that and finding the best solution and being open to the idea that you're not going to be right all the time, and it's not going to go your way all the time, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just the key thing to leadership is those relationships and working collaboratively. So important.
And so do you think that's consistent across Western models of leadership compared to Indigenous models of leadership? And what does Indigenous leadership mean to you?
Well, if we look at traditionally, Indigenous leadership it's about respecting elders, I don't want to say hierarchy because that's a Western word. Within Indigenous communities, my experience is that leadership it comes from the top down in a very respectful manner. Mm-hmm. It used to be like that in Western models of leadership, very hierarchical, but I can see now that people are taking more of that collaborative approach, whereas in community, I think it's collaborative to a point. You've still got, you look at your higher ed, you've still got your elders in residence that you've got to consult, and at the end of the day, if they say nay, it's nay.
Yeah.
And I think you get more resistance because they're the elders, and that's just the way it is. You've got to respect that. And we taught that, but in Western, you can get around that.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's just my experience. Having said that, in Indigenous leadership, it is still like the common objective is for community. It's what's mm-hmm. best for the community. So I'm not saying it's a negative thing at all. Absolutely not. It's always in the best interests of community.
Talking of Indigenous leadership, who are the Indigenous leaders that you look up to, both professionally and personally?
Oh, well, absolutely, Professor Michelle Trudgett. That woman is just, and I do have a professional relationship with her, and I have developed a personal relationship with her, and she is a strong role model in both those areas. She guides me and gives me academic advice, and I take everything that she says on board, but then on a personal level, she'll also go, hey, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and I just look at her and go, you're an outstanding role model. Then there's Professor Sean Ewan, who I adore. I couldn't tell you whether that was a professional relationship or a personal relationship, supposed to be professional, but I think I used to be able to just get under that a little bit. I just bulldoze personal barriers. he's incredible. I wish I'd had the opportunity to work under him more closely because I think I could learn a lot from him professionally. He's got a writing style that is incredible, but more importantly, his leadership as far as going back to building those relationships and navigating his way through challenging discussions, I would just sit and watch him and I'd just think, wow, you are a leader in your own right. So they're my two big ones. They're obviously, they're professors. And I've got other Indigenous people, leaders in my life, like Robin Oxley is an amazing woman. For me, I see her as a role model because she's the world could be falling apart and you wouldn't know it because that woman just gets on with it. She's a tough cookie, right? And I admire that in her. I just look at her strength and just go, damn it, sister, I need some of that. You know, there is somebody who I really admire, but I know her personally to a degree, but not completely. And it's going to sound interesting, but Anita Hess. Mm-hmm. With Anita, I just look up to her because I think she's positive, she's inspirational, she's done it tough herself, she's overcome some significant barriers, and she's willing to help community regardless of her stature, and because she's a high profile. She's the most down-to-earth person, and to me, somebody at that level that can come down to someone like I'm just a nobody and she's like, I will help you, and she gets no kudos for it, she's a role model.
Yeah, fantastic. What do you love about your career and your profession?
That I'm helping community. I see my work as doing something that will benefit the community and benefit generations to come. I feel like I'm a change maker. Like I'm going to drive change for the better of our people. And that's probably another thing that motivates me is that it's not for me. Like nobody's going to know who Stacey Coates is, but I know that the impact that my work will have will be long-term, as I said, over generations, and it will better our people. So yes. It's for community.
What frustrates you as an Aboriginal person working in your career or your industry?
Politics.
Can you elaborate?
And then there's racism. So I have to make sure I come back to that one. So I get frustrated when community members are arguing with each other, and it's not for what purpose? There is to no one's benefit other than just to argue. And I get frustrated if I can't resolve it. It's like, come on, guys, if we could just move past this, we could achieve so much more. So that's really frustrating. And then working with non-Indigenous people, yeah, it's more racism on that side. Drives me insane how, I don't know how many times I get told, but you don't look Aboriginal. Man, are you quarter? Or am I, it's just horrible. So that frustrates me, the ignorance of non-Indigenous people. But I will still stand there and I will educate them. I'll stop whatever's going on. I pick something up and go, oh, hang on a second, that was politically incorrect and racist, and I'm actually going to educate you on how that was politically incorrect and how that's racist and give you something else to think about, whereas I find that other Indigenous people will go, it's not my job to educate them. That frustrates me as well. It's like, well, if you don't educate them, who's going to? We have to. Somebody has to do it. It has to be us. I think
Maybe that comes down to people feeling like there's a workload burden on oppressed people. They're always doing all the extra work to educate people who are ignorant or choose not to go and educate themselves.
Yeah. See, I accept that there are people out there that aren't going to educate themselves, which is why I'll do it.
I mean, you are an educator, Stace, so.
So, and I won't stop because people go, you're going to burn out, you're going to get tired of it. And I'm like, I know my drive. I know how passionate I am. And this flame's not going out.
Yeah.
I will continue to educate people until the day that I die. It's just the way I am. Yeah.
So on that, how do you believe or how do you intend to use your leadership to impact those people or communities that you want to impact?
I don't know. I might be repeating myself here. I don't know. I just think I'm just going to continue with the cause and working with Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. So working with the Indigenous community and building the relationship with them and trying to engage them and get them on board to then come with me on the journey of working with the non-Indigenous people. But my key word is collaboration, right? So I'm going to probably say that 100 times at least. Because I put leadership and collaboration together. And I'm only ever going to achieve what I want to achieve if I work collaboratively with both community and non-Indigenous.
That's another question I've got for you on that is, what does allyship mean to you?
You mean like having non-Indigenous people as allies?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And we have some amazing allies, but I want everybody to be an ally. I want all non-Indigenous people to be allies. And by that, if they're allies, it's because they have an understanding of our culture and our ways and our history, and therefore they will then go on and continue the work that we're doing.
Mm-hmm. What guidance would you give people who believe that they're allies already or who want to become better allies? What advice or guidance would you give them so that they're safe, responsible, and effective?
If they're already considered allies, or they're known to the community as allies, they're already doing those things. So obviously the advice would be, or guidance would be, keep doing those things. Maybe see if they can then shift it to the non-Indigenous people and see if they can encourage other non-Indigenous people to become allies. But then that goes to the next part of the question, that if people wanting to be allies who aren't already, it's about educating them on what it's like to work with community, explain to them that they're not always going to be welcomed straight away and they might be turned away several times before community will even consider talking with them and sharing with them, and that's just the way it is. And these are the things that, you know, potential allies need to accept, and if they're not prepared to accept those things, then they're not going to be allies because they're not going to show the understanding of community. So yeah, go softly, go gently, and be prepared to be turned away. If they are welcomed into community, that they need to demonstrate and maintain the integrity.
So professional networks are really important. And I haven't actually asked this question to any of the other people that I've interviewed yet, but I think it's important. What's the best way that you have found in your career to grow and nurture your professional networks, and how do you use them?
Okay, so obviously to grow them first is to go and meet with like-minded people. So things like the Purge Program, conferences, lectures, just that's the general start of networking to grow it. But then to nurture it, you can't just meet somebody at a conference, take their business card and go, right, you're in my network. You actually need to stay in contact with that person. Not become high maintenance and contact them every day, but just ensure that that you keep the communication open. Same with if you were to do a program like the Poach program, to stay in touch with people that you've now got in your network, you actually just need to continue to communicate. You can't just fall off the face of the earth and think that in 3 years' time, oh yeah, I'm just going to call that person that I did that program with 3 years ago. Doesn't work that way. You've got to nurture them. And it's not about taking either. It's give and take. You don't contact your people in your network just because you want something from them. You may very well go, oh, I've seen this. I know somebody who might appreciate that, and send it on. So mm-hmm. It's giving without taking.
So you've told us a bit about your journey from sort of primary school, secondary school, university, your current career, and where you're hoping to go. If you could go back and talk to your six-year-old self, what would you say? What advice would you give her?
Stay away from boys. Oh, so much. All right, if I go back to when I was six, I was the dumb fat kid, right? I had no self-worth. I was horrible. So I could go back to her and just tell her, don't give up. You're smarter than you think. You are capable of more than they're telling you that you're capable of. Yeah. You've got it in you, girl, and it's going to come out. Don't give up.
Do you think that all those experiences that you had and all the crap that you went through from that age through has made you the powerhouse that you are now?
Hell yeah. Absolutely. Some of it, well, I think maybe I should have said this when we talked about what motivates me, but I actually want to stick it to them. I basically go, you were wrong. I've gone and achieved more than you thought that I would. In fact, my legal studies teacher lives in my street and I drive past his house nearly every day. Do you know how tempted I am to knock on his door and go, fuck you, giving up on me? Look where I am now. And I'm still going. Yeah, absolutely. I've got this drive because I realized I'm not that dumb Aboriginal girl.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also, a big part is I want to help our people.
Yeah.
But yeah, stick it to the ones that said I couldn't do it.
for any young Indigenous person looking to commit to going into a career in education or academia, what advice or guidance would you give them?
All right, there's a couple of things. Firstly, I would suggest that they really dig deep and really ask themselves how passionate they are, because if they don't have that drive, they're not going to enjoy it. They need to have that passion. They need to have that drive. They can't just do it for something to do. And if they have got that drive, then my advice would be go for it. Go hard. Don't give up. You've got it. Even if they say that you can't do it, don't give up. Because I believe that if they have got that drive, then they're capable of it,
mm-hmm.
whether they believe it or not. You've just got to have that determination, that passion, that drive.
How do you think a higher concentration of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander educators would transform the Australian education system?
Well, isn't it power in numbers? And that, do you know, while that response is simplistic, there's some merit to it, because if we're all on the, I don't want to say this, but I don't know how else to say it, but we're all fighting for the same cause and there's a higher concentration of us, people have to listen.
Yep.
And we could shake things up. We could really shake these things up. Like, I'm one person and I'm kicking ass. Can you imagine if we had a whole, army of like-minded, strong Indigenous people? We could really shake things up and we can really make a difference and see a change. Yeah, power in numbers.
What do you see as the major keys to improving Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander lives in Australia?
I don't know if you're going to be surprised with this answer or not, but education. People can talk about health this and health that, but I think education, for so many reasons, if you're educating people, they can, on one side, reduce ignorance and therefore racism. With a strong education, improve our socioeconomic outcomes, mm-hmm. so educating ourselves and therefore going out and being able to, secure careers, not just jobs, but careers in an area of interest, which will then have a flow-on effect in their socioeconomic area. So knowledge is one of the greatest powers we can have.
Mm-hmm.
And, knowledge is power, isn't it?
Absolutely.
That's what they say.
What is your unique vision for Indigenous people both in Australia and around the world?
Oh, see, I could go big and talk about how by bringing awareness to people, reducing racism, that's the big one for me, that we're recognised equally, respectfully, having people acknowledge our way of doing things and how long we've been doing our things. And so acknowledgement, being recognised as equals, reducing racism. This is my vision for all Indigenous peoples, First Nation peoples around the globe. Pretty big vision. I don't know. I think it's achievable.
And you're not alone. It's a whole stack of other people with the same vision.
Yeah. And I think, look, bit by bit, and I might not see it in my lifetime to the extent that I would like, but if I can play a role in working towards that, then my work here is done.
Thank you, Stacey. Thanks so much for the interview and good luck with your professional career. And I look forward to reading your PhD thesis when you finally do it.
Oh, thanks, Pip. It's been a pleasure.